Hello and welcome to Health Matters. I am your host and radio health evangelist, Dr. Tony Weaver. Christmas is over.
Aww.
Presents are open. The tree lies in pieces on the living room floor, and it is time for the Returns and Exchanges show.
And here we are.
To
your
keep
first
you company while you're waiting in line.
Yep.
Thanks to our listeners at True Talk Internet Radio, and with me from the University of Kentucky, Manager of Communications Infrastructure, to explain to you how you can access us after you've finished returning your gifts, Rick Phillips. Hey, Rick.
Hey, Tony. You know you can get the audio of the show at WMKY.org. Do a little search on Morehead State Public Radio's website. Jump around in their menus. You will find Health Matters. There is a list there of the most recent shows. There's summaries for each show. There's a link to the actual audio of the show in case you want to, you know, go back and finish a portion. Maybe you came in late. Maybe you left early. You know, who knows why. Maybe you want to go download it for a friend. Maybe you want to sign up for the podcast. Have Health Matters delivered to you automatically about 4 days after it airs the first time. Certainly, you can find all that at WMKY.org. But then, there's just some times you want to say something. You want to interact. Jump over to Facebook. We love Facebook. HM Radio Show is how you get there. It's Facebook.com/HM Radio Show. There you'll find a fan page. You know, we would say like it. That way you'll be able to see updates when they happen. We normally drop research on there or topics that are in the news or some feedback or comments that we may have received. You might see some of that in there. It gives you the opportunity to interact with the show. Just as we can put stuff up there, you can put stuff up there, and we can respond to it, and we usually do. So I would say that if you have something you want to hear about on the show, certainly put it there on Facebook.com/HM Radio Show.
Our sponsor for today's show, Advanced Planning. Why not start the conversation this holiday season? That's right. Christmas is over. All the excitement's gone, but your kids, your family are still there. It's time to talk a little bit about advanced planning, about your future, and we've talked about this on the show before. There is a website, www.theconversationproject.org, or you can search The Conversation Project, and they will give you a book that I didn't entirely agree with, but a book that will help you start the conversation. And it's not important whether I agree with it or not. It's important that you do this stuff. The book reminds you, 90% of people say that talking with their loved ones about end-of-life matters is important. 27% have done so. 60% say that making sure their family's not burdened by tough decisions is important, but half have not communicated those wishes. 80% say they would want to talk to their doctor about their wishes for medical treatment at the end of their life. 7% have talked to their doctor. 82% say it's important to put things in writing. 23% have done it. Well, it is time, ladies and gentlemen, to do that, to put things in writing. What are you going to put in writing? Well, first of all, I feel, and this is the way we've done it in my family, is you talk about relatives that have passed. What did you like about their final time? What did you not like? What would you do differently? What did you admire and want to emulate in your final days and months? Do you have concerns about what might go wrong? Talk to them about that. Talk before here about making sure they know where accounts are, whatever wishes you have regarding property, and it is very nice. I've heard one person say, I would rather the kids be mad at me than at each other. And Rick reminds you that you need to make sure that they have some access to passwords and resources to make sure that if something were to happen to you, that this stuff would not become lost and go into limbo. And then who would you like to have involved in decisions regarding care? Who would you not like? I don't know what kind of family you've got. I'm not judging you. I just want to make sure that you tell your family who's making the decisions and who's not. And are there any disagreements or tensions over a piece of furniture, over a piece of land, over a piece of whatever? Are there things that your family needs to talk out? It would be a nice thing to do. And then there's one final one, which I think is very important. Are there milestones that you would like to be there for if possible? A birthday, an anniversary celebration, a graduation, things like that. These things are important. I think one of my really significant problems with advanced planning documents is they are so much about disease and so little about life. Frankly, whatever disease I have, whether it's terminal or not terminal, if some important event is coming up, I don't want my family to be torn between staying at my hospital bed where I've clearly checked out and doing something with somebody else in the family. So these things can be important. We had a few years ago, we had a huge change in the inheritance tax where if a person died on December December 31st, the amount of money that their family would get would be extremely different than if they died on January 1st.
Isn't that amazing?
Well, and that would be the sort of thing. Imagine if I came to the emergency room December 31st. You know, you might need to do everything possible to keep me alive to 1201, or you might do everything possible to make sure I didn't make it to 1201, but I'm fine with that. It doesn't matter whether I'm alive 1201. What matters is that my family gets a bigger inheritance if I die a certain year as opposed to another one.
Yeah.
These things, they don't, these are not in your advanced planning documents because we cannot conceive of how life is going to affect you. But if you talk to your family and they can make intelligent decisions for you, that's the big deal. Sorry to go on a rant, but I did. Advanced planning, why not start the conversation these holidays? Now, Rick, you're going to love this. You're absolutely going to love this. This came from Dr. Omer Dulioglu, and I know I mispronounced that, but Dr. Dulioglu is in Turkey, and it was published in the journal Urology back in July, and I don't know how I missed it. I saw it in a summary coming second time around, and we've got to talk about this. The title of this paper in the journal Urology back in July, "Can Sexual Intercourse Be an Alternative Therapy for Kidney Stones?"
Wow.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow.
That makes Viagra seem like a terrible drug.
Makes you sit up. Now, what they did, they said they divided people. They had people with kidney stones. They divided them into three groups. Group one, sexual intercourse at least 3 to 4 times a week. Doctor's orders.
What's this doctor's name again?
Dulioglu, but he's in Turkey.
Oh.
But you can.
But that's worth a plane ticket.
Turkey.
I mean, that's worth a plane ticket.
I mean, it's a little bit dicey there as far as terrorists, but we could try it out. You never know. It might work.
Can they write prescriptions remote?
Patients in group two got Flomax. Flomax is the stuff.
Wow, there's a big difference.
There's so much about this that you're going to love. And group three.
Yeah, I'm going to get the wrong group.
They received standard medical therapy. And that was they got hydration and pain relief, basically, is what they did. And then they checked them in 2 and 4 weeks to see if they passed a stone. If you come into the emergency room with a kidney stone and you're able to hold down fluids and medicines and so forth, they will tell you to drink a lot of fluid and they will send you home from the emergency room. It's not something that needs to be admitted. I had a patient, Rick. He had a number of kidney stones. After about your fourth or fifth, you start to get to be a real pro with these. Most of the time, it's men. Women can have kidney stones. Men are more prone to them than women. And this guy, what he would do is he would get a 6-pack of beer. He lived on a horse farm. He raised horses, and so he would drink beer and ride around on his horses, basically gallop around on his horses until he passed a kidney stone. That's a little tough thing to do,
right?
Because kidney stones hurt, but still, yeah, he did. All right, 2 weeks later, so we're back to our patients. Sexual intercourse 3 to 4 times a week. Flomax, which is a thing for prostate, but it also, we'll explain this a little bit later, it dilates the tubes that drain the kidneys. They got that once a day, or fluids and pain medicines. Now, the people that were in the control group, they got fluids and pain medicines, 35% passed the stone.
Wow.
1 in 3. 2 out of 3, 2 weeks later, still had the stone. Maybe not hurting as much, but still had it. In Turkey, now I don't know how it is in the U.S., but in Turkey, the people that got the Flomax, which is, again, a prostate medicine, half of them passed their stone. That's better than 35%. The people that had sex 3 to 4 times a week, 84%.
Wow.
Passed their stone. 35% control group getting usual care. 50% got the Flomax. 84% in the sexual intercourse group. The mean.
Do you think that is that worth getting kidney stone for?
Well, here's the thing. Now,
that's the question. I mean, I'm sitting here contemplating going, is that worth it?
Well, let's think about how this trial works.
Honey, I got some bad news.
This is how you do science, okay? He has to get these patients. So he goes.
But, I mean, he's going to have one group that's going to volunteer readily.
He's going to go to the emergency room, and he's going to look for people who are having kidney stones.
Right.
And they get their
usual
care. Hey,
buddy, come here for a second.
And he says, can I talk to you for a second? I'm doing a research study. And so he's talking to these guys, and he's saying, here's the research study. You will be in one of three groups. And the thing is, you know, my question, and this is, by the way, this is not in the paper. This is never in the paper. The fun part's never in the paper. Does he bring in the wife? By the way, they had to be married or he wouldn't, this is in Turkey. If they were not married, you could not be in the study. But I think I know the answer to this because I think it's in Turkey. And pardon me if those Turkish people out there, you Turks that are out there, I'm sorry if I'm being insensitive here. I believe he didn't bring in the wives. He just said, men, I've got a research trial.
This would require co-signatures, I would think.
In the U.S., it would. I'm not sure in Turkish society it necessarily would. So he comes in, and these guys have been diagnosed with a kidney stone, and he gets their consent that they'll be in one of the three groups. Now, in order to get consent, you have to tell them the entire study. So everybody knows about group one. Everybody
right.
in the study knows
right.
about group one. Now, you're right, Rick. My luck. I fly to Turkey. I get involved in the study.
You're in group two.
I mean, just...
You're in group two.
There's just no way around it. I'm going to be group two. I am a group two guy.
Right.
I will tell you something. When I get home, my wife is going to reassign me to group two.
Yeah, the question is do they allow veto power in this? I mean, that's the question. Or is it at this point you're just not going to be in one of the groups?
So let's assume, first of all, either the guy has to convince his wife to let him be in the study, or the other thing is he comes home and he says, "Honey, I've got some bad news for you."
Yeah, literally.
Doctor's orders. Now, the thing they didn't do, they didn't actually, by the way, they told, it gets worse. Group two and three were told not to have sex at all.
Wow.
Yeah. 2 weeks. I mean, these other group ones living it up, right? Group two and group three, they are pushing fluids or taking prostate pills.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. I'm just going, gee. I mean, it makes you think maybe I don't want to be in the study because it's group two and group three. I got a 2/3 chance that I'm going to be in group two or three, which is not
your luck. That's your luck.
Yeah. So you've got, first of all, you know, you're told about this fantastic study. Then you find you're in group two, or either that, or I've got to go home and convince my wife I'm in group one.
How much money would you have to slip them to be in group three?
Unethical. Absolutely unethical. So he said,
"You're really going to think about that at a time like this?"
I'm still stuck on how I'm going to convince my wife I'm in group one.
It's a prescription, Tony. It's a prescription. Those are legally binding.
Now here's the, you ask yourself, okay, this is a lot of fun. There actually is some science behind this. The very thing that dilates the blood vessels that allows a man to have an erection would also dilate the tubes that drain the kidneys.
Which would thus,
yep, nitric
when we
oxide,
say dilate, we mean get open up.
Yeah, open up the blood vessels to the diaper area and also open up the tubes that drain the kidneys. So it is quite possible that if you were to trigger your body to make extra nitric acid, nitrous oxide, you might actually dilate those tubes that drain the kidneys and pass a stone easier. One of the editorialists, and I don't know if he was serious or not, says one is left wondering if maybe more would be better. We don't know the number of times they had sex per week. They were just asked to have sex at least 3 to 4 times a week. And we don't know that the other guys didn't have sex at all. They were told not to. But again, this was not the actual number of times was not recorded. I thought, though, a fascinating piece of science rooted in some physiologic principles. And also, it made me laugh.
Yeah.
It made me laugh a lot when I started thinking about how I would set this study up. I am on an institutional review board. We have to review the ethics of studies, and we would have a very difficult time with this. I am absolutely certain. We haven't had a difficult time wasting the first fractional portion of our show, though. We're going to take a break. You're listening to Health Matters on Morehead State Public Radio. Stay tuned.
Hello and welcome back. This is the second fractional portion of Health Matters. I'm still trying to figure out how to get into group three, and I'm Rick Phillips.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver, a firm group tour. This is the Returns and Exchanges show. We're here to keep you company while you're waiting.
Boy, was it an exchange.
At the customer service center, you lucky dog, you get to actually create some extra financial windfall by returning whatever it is that you're returning, and we will talk you through the line. Our sponsor for the second time, Advanced Planning. Why not start the conversation this Christmas? Reminding you, people do not do this. Among severe or terminally ill patients, fewer than half of them had advance directive in their medical record. 2/3 of doctors whose patients had an advance directive were not aware it existed. I have many, many problems with advance directives. We talked about some in the first fractional portion. We talked about some here. I think, though, that the process of filling out an advance directive, if it leads to a conversation with your physician, if it leads to a conversation with your family, is a good thing. What are we talking about? We're talking about who should be making decisions for you if you become incapacitated, who should not be making decisions, how to address tensions that are in your family or disagreements, things that are important to you, things that are not important to you, people who have had an exceptionally good death, in your opinion, relatives, friends, people that the family would know, and what made that a good death, people who were not treated well in their final days and why they were not treated well. Take some time to talk with your family so that when you get to a very critical situation, everybody knows your wishes. They can all speak with your voice, and this will save your family a lot of disagreements and a lot of discord. And we've all seen it where people have different interpretations of what you would have wanted, and it tears a family up. For the sake of your family, talk to them about what's important to you and things that are not important to you if you were to become severely ill. That's our sponsor, Advanced Planning. Why not start the conversation this Christmas? And there is an online resource called The Conversation Project. Search for that, and they will give you some material to help break the ice. It's an awkward thing to start, but it is very valuable for your family. Now, Rick, we're going to get more serious now.
I'm ready.
We've been asked before to talk about high blood pressure because there have been changes in high blood pressure. You know, I think...
You know, yeah, we talked about this a little bit, and we closed out with it, but we didn't actually cover the content last week, but we did the closeout, and it was extremely confusing. I mean, we had trouble reading it. The numbers were so weird.
Yeah, there have been... I think I sort of liken it to breast cancer screening. There are groups that feel that we should be more aggressive, that we should tolerate some harm being done by the screening process in order to screen as aggressively as possible. There are groups that feel that if the process causes harm, it is not worth the additional advantage. And the actual advantage of screening is somewhat difficult to tell as far as breast cancer. I think in the same way, there's general agreement that treating high blood pressure is a good idea, but the actual cut points have been very difficult. 70 million people in the U.S. have a blood pressure over 140 on the top number. It's interesting. When you are a young person, the bottom number is most important. When I graduated medical school, when I first went into my practice after I finished my residency, we didn't even, we recorded the top number, but we simply did not do anything about it. Your top number could go as high as it went. We were focused on the bottom number. We now know that that top number contributes a lot to your risk of disease. And so after age 50, the top number, they call it systolic hypertension. An elevated top number is the most common form of high blood pressure after age 50. And it is more important. The top number is more important than the bottom number as a risk predictor. First of all, what's a top number and a bottom number? You have a blood pressure, and let's just say you are in a very healthy range. It's 120 over 80, which is a very nice blood pressure. That means that when in between heartbeats, when your heart is filling up with blood, your blood pressure is 80 millimeters of mercury. Yes, there is blood flowing down your blood vessels. They are stretched. Yes, if you were to cut yourself, to cut through a blood vessel, even when the heart was filling up with blood, blood would still come out of that artery because you have a blood pressure. That's the bottom number. We call that diastolic. That's in between heartbeats. When the heart beats to push blood out, that's the top number. So you've got this constant diastolic blood pressure with pulses of systolic blood pressure. You've got a constant bottom number with pulses of the top number, and that's why the top number is always going to be higher than the bottom number. I will have patients say, well, my bottom number is higher than my top number. And I tell them, no, that's not possible unless your heart is actually sucking blood out of your blood vessels, which hearts tend not to do. So that's the top number and bottom number. The top number called systolic blood pressure, the bottom number diastolic blood pressure. Systolic hypertension, an elevated top number, the most common form of high blood pressure after age 50, and a more important risk predictor of your risk of having heart disease, stroke, and other problems than the bottom number is. Blood pressure now is worldwide the leading risk factor for death and disability, or at least it was in 2010. Cigarettes are working on that. We've introduced, the U.S. has used our trade partnership agreements to introduce cigarettes to the developing world, and we're busy creating a generation of lung cancer victims thanks to our exporting our tobacco. But as of right now, blood pressure is the leading risk factor for death and disability worldwide. If you treat high blood pressure, if you treat it in the way that we've been treating it all along, it can cut your risk of having a heart attack by up to 25%, your risk of having heart failure by 2/3, your risk of having strokes by around 30%. Treating blood pressure is a good idea. Now, the problem is we don't know how low to make the blood pressure go.
Right.
We know when we just look at people and we measure their blood pressure and follow what happens to them, it appears that the best blood pressure is around 115 to 120 systolic, 115 to 120 on the top number. That is the safest blood pressure. Now, what we don't know is if we use chemicals and medicines to get you to a blood pressure of 120 or less, does that make you healthier? It's the old, we've used it many times in the show. If I wear large shoes, that does not make me an NBA basketball player, even though I observe that NBA basketball players all wear large shoes. In the same way, I observe that a blood pressure of 115 is a very good, very healthy blood pressure. I don't know if I make my patient's blood pressure 115, I have made them healthy.
Well, I mean, it's the same argument that we've had with cholesterol-lowering medicines, right? I mean, we can lower people's cholesterol with medication. Does it help?
Yeah.
And that's, I mean, that's the research question right now is I think you got up until recently, it was always pretty easy to answer that question. Now it's a little more difficult.
Now, if you ask people, what's the target blood pressure worldwide, the target that has been used for many years is 140 over 90.
And really?
Yeah.
Because I would have always, if you'd asked me that, even when I worked in biomed and was in this all the time, we always looked at 120 over 80. That was the world standard.
That's ideal. That's ideal if you can get there. But if you,
I'm ideal,
yeah,
Tony.
But the thing is, if you're trying to load people up with pills, 140 over 90 is where we stop. And this was based on research that was done in the 60s and 70s. This was when we proved that treating high blood pressure helped people, and we used 140 over 90 as our target. And it seemed like with the medicines we had in the 60s and 70s that that was a point where the benefits started to taper off. So that was 140 over 90 for a long time. Now, we got more serious back with the Joint National Committee, JNC. The Joint National Committee makes recommendations in the U.S. for how you should treat high blood pressure. And we got more serious. We thought, well, look, people with diabetes and people with kidney failure have really bad heart health. Diabetes and kidney failure are horrible risk factors for kidney disease. Maybe we should make their blood pressure go lower. And so we looked at a target of 130 on the top number for them instead of 140. The problem was there were two fairly large and fairly well-done trials that did not show any benefit to treating to those lower values. So when we finally published the guidelines, they were delayed by about 5 years, but when we finally published the eighth opinion of the Joint National Committee, we call it JNC8, they said, look, we can't say that anything should be less than 140 over 90, even people with diabetes and kidney disease. And further, we had done some specific work in older people, and so they recommended if you're over age 60, the top number, the target for the top number should be less than 150. Now, what you've got to realize, going back to what we talked about with mammograms, is there are some people who feel that there should be more aggressive blood pressure treatment. They will get better outcomes. There are other people that feel there should be less aggressive because more aggressive is more risky. The more aggressive people were not happy with the JNC8 recommendation. To say the least, they were not. In fact, when it came out, even some people on JNC8, about a third of them, wrote a separate paper, said, we're not sure this 150 thing is the right way to go. The evidence was weighed, and again, it's everybody's idea of risk and benefit. No one's arguing about numbers, but everybody's arguing about where they would interpret those numbers. And so there was quite a bit of disagreement, unease in the community. Now, I went on this show, and I said, here's what JNC8 says, and it looks like we can back down a little bit. At that time, we had the diabetic trial and stroke. We didn't see any improved outcomes. It looked like that the less treatment people were going to hold sway. And the other thing is, at that time, we were dropping our recommendations on prostate cancer screening. We have modified our breast cancer screening. It looked like pretty solidly across the board, we're talking about less intervention, less invasiveness in our treatment. And so that's where we were when JNC8 came out back, I think that was 2011 or so. And we went on this show and said, well, here's the recommendation. Well, now we've got some new data. This was something called the SPRINT trial, and this has really flipped the script a little bit on how to treat blood pressure. This was 100 clinical sites, and they had thousands of people enrolled, and I don't have the number, but many thousands of people enrolled in this. They followed them for 3 years. They had two things they did. One group got what they call standard treatment, get it under 140, and as a matter of fact, shut down if it gets below 130. In other words, they wanted that 130 to 140 range, and they actually diminished the medicines in order to hit that range. They did not want to overtreat. The other group, they treated them more aggressively. You name a blood pressure medicine, they were about 20% more likely to be on that medicine. They were going 3 and 4 medicines regularly, and their target was to get the top number under 120. So we had two groups, each with thousands of people in it. One stopped at 140. They were in the 130s. They were reliably in the 130s. One kept pushing ahead with newer medicines than we had back when we did our first trials, and they were going for less than 120. After 3 years, there was a significant difference in the risk of having heart attack, a significant difference in the risk of having what they call cardiovascular events. That's adding up heart attacks, strokes, bypass surgeries, and things like that. And they actually had a lower rate of dying from anything. They call it death from any cause. They lived longer. So at 3.25 years, they ended the trial early because there was a significant difference. Published it in the New England Journal. Editorial said, well, that whole 150 thing is too high for elderly people. And one editorialist says, I think even people over age 50 should have blood pressures below 130. don't know where that came from, but that's the way the experts are lining up. I would say between that and some other articles published, I think the idea of using 150 as a target is probably gone away. Do not see that happening. I don't know if we're going to go below 140 for everybody. The sprint trial, they did not have any diabetics in it. They excluded diabetics because they already had a really pretty good trial saying it didn't work for diabetics. So they did not try to repeat that trial. Some people are going to extrapolate that to diabetics, but right now, the best evidence we have says diabetics should be treated to 140 over 90 or less and not to lower targets. But high risk, and these were the people that got in the trial, people who were at high risk, and I believe it was over 15% risk, 10-year risk of having a heart attack. You can do that with that Framingham risk calculator. Those were the people they wanted, non-diabetics, people who hadn't had strokes but at high risk of heart attack. When they treated them aggressively, they found an improvement. This is something you're going to have to talk with your doctor. You know, I think, Rick, where we're headed is there's not going to be a number.
Right. Don't you think it's going to be like everything else? It's going to be so personalized that every person's going to have their number. I mean, isn't your Fitbit someday going to tell you what your number is?
Right.
And whether you're getting close to it or not?
And you should be able to actually look at your metabolic parameters. You say, this is the best weight for me. This is the best blood pressure. Now, I may not be able to hit it.
Now, is that the best weight with chocolate or without?
Well, I'm saying, you know, that you will not hit your best.
Right.
Or very few of us will, because there are a lot of other things in life other than hitting our best. But we will at least know something about based on our history and our risk of diseases. And so, again, if you've got a person who has a fantastically high level of good cholesterol and no family history of heart disease anywhere, but their family all dies of their eyeballs exploding, there's really no point in treating their blood pressure aggressively. What you need to do is to try to decompress their eyeballs or give them goggles. I don't know what, but something like that. The point is, you know, we all have these different risks, and trying to treat us all to one number, no matter what that number is. This is kind of the last-ditch effort to say, well, whatever the number is, it should not be the 150, that we can treat aggressively and we can lower a person's risk. You're going to need to talk with your doctor about this, arrive at something that you are both comfortable with, but the world is changing. I do not expect an expert opinion that everybody can, over age 60, can be satisfied with the blood pressure of 150 on the top number. Just not seeing that anymore. Make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. What's next? I'm just being quiet because I know the next topic you got is going to be fun. I'm doing that thing they do in meetings where the quieter you are, the quicker you go through the agenda.
You get through the other stuff, huh?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, hey.
Well, you know, this the sprint trial was really about life changing, I think.
What part of next? No, I'm just kidding.
And so we had a couple of things. I got a little bit of time left this segment. I want to talk about a couple of things that changed. And keep in mind, our listeners right now, they're all standing in line at customer service waiting. They don't have the receipt. It was a gift. They didn't have the receipt. And so they're just going to try to beg to get their money back.
Gift card from that store. That store will usually give you an in-store gift card.
Point is, expectations for the show are low this week. We know that. And so we're going to milk that a little bit.
Why didn't we just have a rerun? If we know that expectations are going to be low.
Can you imagine how a person would feel if they're waiting in the exchange line and they get a rerun? I wouldn't do that to our radio fans, Rick. You might do that to our radio fans, but I wouldn't. I have more respect for our fans than that.
Boy, now you're laying it on thick. Now you're just saying, yeah, yeah.
All right. December 4th, Radiologic Society of North America 2015 annual meeting. This just gives you an indication of where things are going. And it's a manufactured headline. I don't want to be a shill for an industrial trade group, but it is a manufactured headline. What they said is demand grows for printed pre-surgical 3D models. And this is Gerald Grant, University of Louisville, gave a talk, and he said, this is what he said, trying to show patients a CT scan is nothing like holding a model in your hand and showing them where the tumor is and why you have to come in from this approach because of this nerve or that vein or that artery. That is, it may, and they may very well be right, it may be that instead of getting, right now, you get, many times you'll get a DVD of your MRI scan. At an MRI scan, she comes home, she's got an envelope with a DVD in it.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we got it. We can look at her MRI scan. Sometime when things get a little bit slow, we just pop it in and
right.
Get some popcorn and watch
it. You know,
MRI.
I mean, you don't have the greatest TV out there at your place, so, you know, you got to do something.
Yeah, it's a little fuzzy. But at any rate, what if instead of
you're
the
not in group three.
Hand... You're going to bring that up. Once you're group two, apparently you don't get any respect in the studio. But instead of getting a picture of, it used to be you could get a picture of your chest x-ray. Then we got digital, so you can get a CD or a DVD of your chest x-ray. Well, now the idea is the radiologist comes in and hands you a model.
Right.
A plastic model.
I mean, honestly,
the
dentist has been showing you a model of your teeth for years, right? I mean, you go in the little, how many people have been in the waiting room and the doctor takes a little model off the shelf and says, here's what we're going to do. This is kind of what your anatomy might look like.
Right.
Well, all we're doing is we're saying, this isn't what it might look like. We're saying, we scanned you and this is what it does look like. This is what it actually looks like. Here is your anatomy part.
Right. And model and to scale. This is the size
look
of the
tumor.
Look
how big your heart is.
Or whatever. And so, you know, here's the thing. I mean, this is a good idea. The surgeons, they want these 3D models so that they can actually plan the surgery out.
Absolutely.
I don't know if the patients want the models or not. What will happen is the radiologist is going to give me a model of my prostate gland. And
you're going to say, ooh, I don't want to see that.
No. You know what happens when somebody does that? I'm going to take that model home.
And put it on the mantle.
Put it on a shelf somewhere. And then I would say, well, you know, the kids might want this model.
Like the teeth, right?
Yeah, sure. The kids, I bet the kids will want this. I better figure out.
Any parent that's kids had braces, you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, and so, you know, what happens when the tooth fairy gets their teeth? Do you give them back their teeth? What happens when
you
they do a 3D?
You just ruined 3D printing for me. Think about that during the break.
You're going to have to figure out what to do with the 3D model when the radiologist gives it to you. You're going to have to figure out what to do with a break because we're about to give you one. Stay tuned for our third and final fractional portion. You're listening to Health Matters on Morehead State Public Radio.
Hello and welcome back. This is the third and final fractional portion of Health Matters. I'm Rick Phillips.
And coming to you from Group 2.
Firmly in group two.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is
with your 3D printed
prostate gland sitting proudly on the mantle. I've earmarked that for my son. I think it'd be more important that he has it after I'm gone.
I don't exactly think that's going to be a bonding opportunity for the two of you.
Let me show you
something.
Yeah, a DVD is, you know, the kids are going to look at a DVD. They'll just toss it.
Merry Christmas.
There is no DVD. Yeah, the one thing that I know is that there's no DVD that I've got that the kids would ever want. They'll toss that, but I don't know what they're going to do with the 3D model.
Prostate. We talked about this a few months ago on another show. I mean, there's the 3D printing stuff is going to keep finding its way back. I mean, at some point, you're going to be able to get a 3D model of your 12-week-old gestating baby. I mean, it's going to be, you know, some of the things are going to be able to print.
Oh my gosh! And so, well, you take it home and dress it up.
Don't go there.
Oh,
I'm just saying.
Very unsettled.
There are so many things that you're looking at this stuff from the patient standpoint. There's obviously a lot of areas where the physicians and the medical practitioners can learn from the anatomy and learn. I mean, how many times do you just need to see it?
Right.
I mean, you know, you look at your car engine and you go, wow, something's wrong with that. And it's up under, it'd be nice if I could see in there. Well, now they can. And it's just so cool.
Absolutely. This is the Returns and Exchanges show. For the final time, our sponsor, Advanced Planning. Why not start the conversation this holiday season? We've talked about many people feel that it's a good idea to talk to their family, to write down their wishes in the event of something catastrophic happening to them. Very few people actually do it. If you are going to have the quality death that you want, if you are going to have that death with dignity that we're all looking for, you need to take some simple steps to let your family know what your wishes are. And I think this conversation starts with recently passed relatives, the good and the bad that happened with them, things that you would want, things that you would not want. It is an ongoing conversation. You have to find some way to start it. As Rick and I have talked about, it not only involves would you want a tube or would you want to have CPR done, it's really about how do you approach these illnesses, who makes the decisions for you, who does not make the decisions for you, what are you worried about, what concerns you most about death and dying, what worries you about your family. And while you're doing that, again, having the person to be your health proxy, your healthcare proxy, having a person to help with financial property and so forth, telling them your wishes is a great thing that you can do that will keep your kids from having an argument after you're gone. Do it for your family. Talk to them about what you would like for yourself and for your property should you not be there. Begin the conversation this holiday season. That's our sponsor, Advanced Planning. Now, I've got a couple of things that I thought would be worthwhile putting on here. And one, I'm going to finish this segment up, or I may get to it early in this segment because I'm so excited about it. I just read something in Nature that absolutely knocked my socks off. And so I want to make sure that I share that with you guys. First thing comes, though, from Los Angeles Times, December 7th, Pearl Harbor Day. American teens exercise 39 minutes a day. They recommend that kids should get at least 30 minutes of school time exercise because that'll get them halfway to the 1 hour a day we're looking for, but instead 23 minutes, according to pediatrics. And this was not a fill out a questionnaire thing. They actually took 550 volunteers, Seattle and Baltimore. They put GPS monitors and activity trackers. At this point, we don't have to ask them to fill out questionnaires and tell stories or exaggerations. We actually can track them. Location, movement, once every 30 seconds for about a week, figuring out where they are and how fast they are moving. American teens, reputation for being among the most sedentary in the world. Only 8% get 60 minutes of exercise a day. This leads to then a lifetime of chronic diseases. It takes away their potential. Your child does not live up to their potential, not because you didn't send them to the best school or buy them the computer or whatever it is you were supposed to do, but because they don't get enough exercise to fight off these diseases. So they got the 550 volunteers, ages 12 to 16, 42% of their time in school, 28% at home, 13% in the neighborhood, 39.4 minutes of exercise a day, 23 minutes of that in school. And on school days, that's about half of their daily minute, but it's just not enough minutes. On weekends, got a little bit worse than that, and they actually were less active on weekends. In each of these locations, boys got more exercise than girls. We're going to have to figure this out for designing programs to boost physical fitness because our school systems are not getting the job done. I'm not blaming the teachers. I'm not blaming the school system, but we have to find a way to make it agreeable to the kids to exercise. That's what we're going to need. That's what I learned from the Los Angeles Times on December 7th. Now, got to talk to you, Rick, about, and I'm sorry to do it. This is going to glaze. First of all, Rick, as you may have noticed, has been hovering in the ethosphere while I talked about exercise.
You know, well, you talked about exercise, and you know, you started. I like math, but 120 over 80, 140 over 22, 68 over 73. Unless I'm playing craps, I really don't like numbers like that.
I understand. I've tried.
Come on, seven.
I've tried to give you something to talk about in the first fractional portion.
So No. You gave me 3D printing last section.
Yeah,
and that was phenomenal. But you don't want to talk about the things we can print these days. Right?
Horrible thoughts just came to my mind when you said,
why?
I don't want to talk about the stuff you can print these days.
No, you don't want to talk.
The stuff you can print these days is something that's unspeakable. And I started thinking, what could you print that was unspeakable? And unfortunately, I came up with about four examples.
Well, I didn't mean it like that. I mean, you know, you can print toothpicks. You can print forks.
Yeah.
I mean, you've run out of paper plates, print you some.
I love this. Really, I think I'll
look,
put
you don't want to get you really don't want to get me started
on the mantle
about medical and actual just regular general commercial reasons for 3D printing. I am a huge fan of 3D printing.
Now, okay,
and I'm at this point, I am willing to trade with my wife. I will get out of group three if I can have a 3D printer.
I'll keep the kidney stone for an extra 5 days. That's basically what you're saying. I'll keep a kidney stone an extra 5 days, knowing full well that I could have passed this thing
exactly
before if you had been cooperative. But never mind about that. I'm doing this for you, but I need a 3D printer.
Exactly.
Now, let me ask you, are you seeing 3D printers in use?
Yeah. I mean, there certainly MSU has them. The Space Science Center has them. UK has them. We're seeing more and more of them. Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas is coming up in a few weeks. There's an entire exhibit hall devoted to 3D printing. I mean, Tony, I was actually online the other day looking for something. They make chargers for my fitness band, and there was a stand that you could get. You could buy this stand, and the power cord would basically push into this stand so that you could just walk up and it's a magnetic thing. You could put your band on this magnet and it would automatically attach the leads and then you would charge your band, right? So it's just a little bitty stand that's on
you. Just drop your watch off without
exactly
hook up things.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it just hooks up automatically. And so I went online to look at it. It was $15 if you wanted to buy the stand, or it was $4.99 if you wanted to download the 3D model and print it yourself. Think about that. That's coming. There will be a time where when you're out in the garage and you break a gear on a particular device, you will not have to go to Sears part store online and find it. You will not have to go to Radio Shack and try to hunt and dodge and see everything. You will be able to literally go to the website, pull down a 3D model, pay them 38 cents or $27 or whatever, and you will literally be able to print that thing right there in your home. It's coming. We can laugh, we can joke. Their 3D printing is not going away.
Now, I got to say, I've got a new perspective on this, because last week we had a lot of fun talking about Christmas toys. Of course, Christmas is gone. It's done. This is the sober reality of the end of 2015.
I am not taking back the 3D printer that my wife will get me. I'm sorry. She's going to get me for Christmas.
But here's the thing. Rick made a comment about kids today missing out on the Sears catalog.
Exactly.
The Sears catalog, where you would look, you would see these toys, you would perhaps put a circle around some of them.
Full pages. You got to fold pages.
Thought control lines to make sure that your parents knew what you were going for. For Rick, I think the Consumer Electronics Show in Vegas is, in fact, the modern-day Sears catalog. This is Christmas for a techno guy.
You can... It absolutely is. I mean, and the thing is, here's the funny thing is, at that show, you'll see all the things that will show up in both our homes and our workplaces in the next 3 to 5 years. You know, they will. And say say what you will, but fitness wearables, right? So fitness wearables have been around three years now, where they've been getting real popular. Well, UK just announced a program a couple of weeks ago where if you're an employee, you get an incredible price on a series of Fitbits. Depending on which model you want, you can get literally a $150 Fitbit for like $70. I mean, and so you don't think that those aren't going to show up all over the campus at UK, and there's not going to be Bluetooth flowing around everywhere that we have to deal with on our wireless spectrums and our all the radio frequency spectrums that we have to worry about for communications.
When you talk about the pulse of campus, is it going to be an actual
literally? And so you start looking at this show, and this show gives me insight as to what we as a technologist are going to have to deal with in 3 to 5 years. That's just the way it is. Tony, how many times have I called you for how many times have you called me for help on something?
Many.
It happens. I get calls from a lot of people. How do we stay out in front of that? By going to things like this. I've had Windows 10 now for a year. There's not many Windows 10 questions you can ask me that I don't know the answer to.
There you go. Are you finished?
No, are you?
Well, I got to get back to drugs, and you're not going to like this.
Okay, well, just let me know when you're done.
Okay, so Rick's going to wander off again. I'm going to talk to you about my favorite drug, the one, but this is in my mind, this is the grapefruit of diabetic drugs. There's something called SGLT2 inhibitors. These are the drugs that make you pee your sugar down to a certain level. The brand names you probably know, Jardiance, Farxiga, and Invokana. They're advertising heavily because they are expensive as all get out. They lower your blood sugar. If you have what we call type 2 diabetes, they will lower your blood sugar. They do that by making you pee more sugar out. They don't change the sugar level in the bloodstream directly. They don't change how your body handles sugar, except more of it goes in your pee. The FDA issued and here's the problem, that Jardiance did a research project that showed that this was the first diabetic medicine since metformin, a brand name Glucophage. This was the first diabetic medicine that actually lowered your risk of having a heart attack. Many others have looked at it. Some of them may actually raise your risk of a heart attack, but Jardiance, which is one of these drugs, actually lowered your risk of a heart attack. I couldn't believe it. I hate these drugs with a passion. They don't seem to do anything for diabetes except you just pee your numbers down to a proper number, and I could not figure them out, and yet they may actually do some long-term good in people with diabetes. So I'm confessing that I don't like where these drugs are, but that I may be, in fact, missing on something big. More on that in a minute. Right now, the FDA has issued a safety communication. This was back in May. They said, you can get, if you just pee your sugar down to a certain level, you can get into some serious problems with something called ketoacidosis. That is, the sugar level looks good, but your body is still acting like you've got too much sugar, and you can set up some pretty significant complications. They said that looking from March 2013 to May 2015, basically 2 years and change, 73 cases reported, and this is a new side effect, so probably more than that exist, of ketoacidosis, a particular type of diabetic complication in people who are on these drugs. What happens is they start to get extremely nauseated, abdominal pain, vomiting. They have difficulty breathing because they get high levels of acid in their blood, and they have to breathe really hard to make up for that. They also, the FDA has identified 19 cases of blood infections and kidney infections that started because they put so much sugar in the urine that the germs started growing in the urine. All 19 were hospitalized. Few required admission to the ICU or kidney dialysis in order to treat kidney failure because of these infections. So again, I never liked these drugs. These drugs do have some significant side effects. In the research, one of these drugs has been associated with a lower risk of having a heart attack, and I'm struggling then with, are they worse, I think, than the drugs we've had? Are they better than the drugs I've had? But what the FDA has done, they put new safety warnings about the ketoacidosis, new safety warnings about the risk of infection because you're peeing off basically bacterial food with all the sugar that goes in your urine. Their recommendation just that you should stop taking these medicines if you have symptoms of ketoacidosis, and certainly you should be aware of the fact that you are at higher risk for a urinary tract infection. They're not going to pull them off the market. My initial thought was, when I saw all these side effects, I thought these drugs won't make it till Christmas. Oh, they have far surpassed making it till Christmas. Right now, the question is, should we be switching our patients to these drugs to lower the risk of heart attack? But they do have side effects, and be aware of that. Now, I said I didn't understand Jardiance. Why does this drug seem to improve your risk of having lower your risk of having a heart attack, improve your overall health, when it sort of ignores your diabetes and just makes you pee a lot? I didn't know.
That's why we create drugs, to have those things like that.
The
annoyances.
Well, let's go back to the one diabetic drug, and this includes insulin as well, the one and only diabetic drug that before Jardiance actually seemed to improve outcomes. This is something called metformin. It is the first line dirt cheap nickel a tablet drug that we use for type 2 diabetes. You should, if you're not on this drug or weren't started on this drug, talk to your doctor about it, because if you can tolerate this drug, it is a great choice. It actually makes your weight hold steady or perhaps lose weight. It lowers your risk of heart attack. It appears to lower your risk of cancer. We're not entirely certain on that, but it's possible that it could lower your risk of cancer, and people with diabetes actually have a raised risk of cancer. Well, this was from the journal Nature, which is a very, very high quality journal, and was published by a group out of, it was a consortium of European and Chinese researchers looking at metformin. Now, Rick, we have talked a lot about the microbiome, the germs that grow in and around your body, and how they are a part of you. They are not invaders. In fact, they are an essential part of you. 100 trillion bacteria hiding in our intestines. Keep that in mind. We've talked about it before. Something wipes out 99.9% of all bacteria. You're still looking at billions of bacteria.
Billions.
Yeah. But we can't grow them, because they live in your gut, and your gut doesn't have any oxygen. When we bring them out into the air, they just die. We did not know what these germs were. We could not figure that out until we did this DNA analysis, and now we're finding germs we had no idea were there. It turns out that metformin changes the germs that are present in your colon.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, so maybe it's affecting your sugar, or maybe it's making you grow healthier germs in your colon. That's the question. We've never seen a drug that affected those germs before. We know that metformin makes you fart a little bit. Metformin gives you abdominal distress. It appears to create a healthier set of germs in your colon, and that may be one of the ways that it affects your risk of having a heart attack. Now, if that's the case, then that goes back to Jardiance, right?
Right.
All of a sudden, a drug that I don't like could be a very beneficial drug if it happened to do that thing.
This is one of those cases where I'm just going to take my doctor's advice.
All right, stay tuned on this. We believe that this gut flora is going to be a huge thing, and it may determine whether or not your diabetic medicine actually is beneficial. We have to determine whether we can stay on the air, and in fact, we can. Get us off the air, Rick.
Special thanks to Morehead State Public Radio producer Hunter Reese and to Eric Bilbrey, who wrote our Health Matters theme song, and to you, our loyal radio fans. Remember to show your support for Health Matters by visiting our digital empire. To listen to the show, go to WMKY.org, or just visit us on Facebook. Just do a search for HM Radio Show.
For our radio crew and the supportive folks at the Northeast AHEC, thanks for listening to our show, and remember,
Health Matters is one of a class of prescription radio shows that are FDA approved for use with diet and exercise to lower blood sugar in adults with type 2 diabetes. This class includes Invokana and Jardiance.
An FDA safety review has resulted in additional warnings to the labels of a specific class of diabetes radio shows about the risk of too much acid in the blood and of serious kidney infections. Both conditions can result in hospitalization.
A review of the FDA database from March 2013 to May 2015 identified 73 cases of acidosis. Symptoms of diabetic acidosis include nausea, vomiting, abdominal pain, tiredness, and trouble breathing.
The FDA also identified 19 cases of life-threatening blood infections and kidney infection, starting as a urinary tract infection. infection between March and April and October of 2014. All 19 patients were hospitalized and a few required ICU admission or dialysis.
The FDA added new warnings and precautions to the labels of all medicines and radio shows of this class to describe these two safety issues. The FDA is also requiring manufacturers and Health Matters to perform analysis of reports of acidosis for a period of 5 years.
Whatever you do, do not take Health Matters lying down. Get out this week, make a healthy change in your life, and tune in next week as we determine whether people with pigeon toes are better at climbing statues on Morehead State Public Radio.